I came from a beautiful neighborhood. I had a beautiful life.
I went to sleep because September 7th was the first day of my high school year. I was going to be a senior.
At 22, I was set to start college.
I woke up and my life was never the same again.
Cops came out with guns drawn, and I never saw freedom ever since after that.
It's like Roach Motel. Once you get in, you're not getting out.
This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Today's guest is Richard Rosario. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Richard was convicted of a murder that happened in the Bronx while he was 1,000 miles away in Florida with 13 alibi witnesses and various other types of evidence to back it up. But let's go back. So you were born in
Puerto Rico. My parents were, at the time, my mother was a seamstress. My father used to work labor, and they were poor by definition, by today's definitions. But we had a house. We had a little mango tree in the front of the house. It was beautiful. I mean, you didn't have all the luxuries that you see in America, but you have what you need. You know, you had the
good food, weather,
the sustenance, great weather, and people that loved you. There wasn't a day that I would go to sleep hungry or, you know, have any troubles in school or anything. So it was beautiful.
When did you come here?
When I was 5 years old. Immigrated to the United States, and we resided in the Bronx in 1980-81. We started living in the Bronx, and it's an experience because you're an immigrant. You don't know English, so you have to acclimate to a whole new culture.
Right.
And the culture in New York back then was hip-hop, and, you know, this whole drug phase happened in New York at the time where there was a lot of crime, and the streets was riddled with that. So here I am, a young boy from Puerto Rico who wasn't never exposed to that type of stuff, being exposed to this different type of culture.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had. I have two brothers and five sisters. At that time, my mom separated from my dad, and it was one of the reasons why she relocated to the United States to find new life. And, you know, everybody that comes and migrates to the United States to find a new life, a better life. And she came here single parent and raised us on her own in the South Bronx. New York was my main, everything I knew. So Puerto Rico wasn't appealable to me as a teenager. So I stopped going at the age of 13.
I mean, we know New York was a little, we're now in
89.
So yeah, it was kind of the height of the crime wave. Things were getting crazy, right?
Yeah.
And then you had a little altercation when you were 15 years old, right?
Yeah, I was a kid, and you know, once again, in Puerto Rico, I never witnessed anything that I've witnessed in the United States, in the Bronx in particular at this time, and for obvious reasons, the crime rate, the drugs, and everything that was happening in this era, it was pretty tough. But, you know, I began, you know, my teenage life trying to follow the new trends, wanting to have those sneakers. My family's poor. We can't afford those sneakers, the Lottos, the new fashion statements back then. And so I started hanging out with the wrong crowd, as most teenagers, and despite what type of environment they grow up with, you meet your contemporaries at the time, and you start acclimating to what they like, well, you know, the music, the style. And living in the South Bronx, that's the environment that I'm acclimating to, where it's crime, it's drugs, it's clothes, it's you have to go out and get it. And so I got with this bad crowd, and, you know, they, one thing that they used to do is go out there and commit crimes to get what they wanted, a shirt, a pair of sneakers and stuff. And unfortunately, I knew it was wrong, but I followed. And I got caught one day. My friends committed a robbery as a kid, and they had the wallet. And my friend was older than me at the time. He was 17 years old. His name is Danny, and he died since. But he passed me the wallet, and I took the wallet, and I put it in my pocket. It had the guy's credit cards, and that was my first interaction with the criminal justice system. I was caught with credit cards in my pocket.
And you got probation for that?
Yes, I got probation.
You're 15 years old, and you weren't a violent guy.
No, I wasn't.
We're going to go now from the time you're 15 to the time you're 20, so we're talking about 1996.
Yes.
Right? In 1996, let's paint a picture here. So you're in Florida.
Yes.
Right? And what were you doing in Florida at the time? First of all, which part of Florida were you in?
I was in Orlando, and the reason why I went over there is, you know, I was a quick learner in life, and I made the mistakes as a teenager. I got in trouble. I had my daughter, and things started dawning on me that I can't live life like this. I have children to take care of. I have, you know, a daughter that's going to look up to her dad and a son that's going to need me there. So I said, it's time for me to change my environment. New York was in the place, the Bronx especially at the time, was in a place where I had opportunities because I had messed up them opportunities as a child. And I was known in the local precinct as, you know, one of these troubled teenagers. And so I wanted to just leave that past and go to Florida and give my family a new life. And, you know, that's what my plans were.
So you went down to Florida to sort of scope it out and try to figure out what kind of opportunities were going to be there for you?
Exactly. And it's basically, you're 20 now, so you're saying, well, I want a
piece of the American
dream. Yeah, I want a piece of the American dream. What does that dream look like to me? To me, it looked like Florida, you know, Sunshine State. It's a slower speed, and I want folks to understand that I was still young and still immature, so, you know, it wasn't beyond me smoking a little marijuana or hanging out in a club, but I wasn't out there, you know, hurting people. And I remember I was in Florida, and I was still, you know, my biggest issue, and I want people to understand, is that I was dealing with individuals that were still into that lifestyle. So although I wasn't into it, these guys were still doing things that weren't good. And I find out from my mother, you know, I call my mother, check up as I usually do, my wife and the kids, how they doing. And they're telling me, the detectives are looking for you. And I'm like, they were just here just a couple months ago. You know, tell them I'm here, I'm in Florida. If they want me, they know where I'm at. She said, well, I told them you was in Florida. They're saying they're looking for you for a murder. And I'm like, I'm thinking at the time, my mother, she knows English, but she's Puerto Rican descent.
Maybe she's confused.
Maybe she's confused, right? But then my sister tells me the same thing, and then my wife tells me the same thing. Detectives are looking for you for a murder. And then they tell me the day, June 19th.
And you had been in Florida for how long?
For a couple months. I was there from May 1st that I arrived to Florida all the way to the time that I came back from Florida.
So you come back, you hear they're looking for you.
Yes.
So you come back to New York.
June 30th, I got on a Greyhound bus, and I arrived July 1st at 6 in the morning, and I called my wife, and I told her I'm heading home right now. And at this time, me and my wife lived separately. I lived at my parents' house until we had enough money to get our own apartment. My wife is living at her parents' house. She was working, so I'm going over to my in-laws' house to see my kids, see my wife before she went to work. 7 in the morning, I get there. And, you know, I had this talk with her, and I told her, listen, I've never killed no one in my life, so I'm going to go to the Bronx. I'll contact the precinct, and I should be home sometime tonight, and we'll talk more. And I spent that afternoon, I made breakfast for my kids. I took them to the park, and I told my daughter that end of the day, and that afternoon before I left to the Bronx, that, you know, she was crying, she wanted to go with daddy, and I told her, I'll be back later on. And I left to go to the Bronx to talk to the police, and I never came back for 20 years.
I just got to digest that for a second. He left her after saying goodbye like any dad would.
Yeah.
I got to go take care of something. I'll see you later. That's the same thing any dad would react.
A 3-year-old girl.
And so you go to the police precinct,
mm-hmm.
and you go in there to clear things up. And what happens?
Well, first I got to the Bronx. I called the detectives. Detective Charles Kruger picks up the phone. He's from the robbery division. He has nothing to do with this homicide. So Charles Kruger tells me, listen, they want to talk to you about some homicide that occurred. And when would be the best time? And I told Charles Kruger, well, I'll be in with my lawyers tomorrow. I'll get to the precinct with my lawyers. I didn't commit a crime. I've been in Florida. And he said, all right. So I hung up the phone. A half an hour later, detectives come to my mother's house. So I look at the peephole and I see the detectives. I open the door. There's nothing for me to worry about. And I let them in the house. They talked to my mother briefly. And this was, Charles Krueger was there, but the main two homicide detectives were Officer Martinez and Gary Whitaker were the two detectives. So they come in. Martinez spoke to my mother, Whitaker spoke to me, and they said, listen, we just want to ask you questions and relating to this murder, and if you were in Florida, we're going to find out, and you're going to be good. And I said, okay, so let's go. And right before we left, they said, but we have to cuff you because it's procedure. And my heart, like, skipped a little bit because I'm saying, wait a minute, I'm leaving with you. Why do you have to put handcuffs on me? I'm telling you, I'm innocent and I have evidence and I'm leaving with you. It's not like I'm running. I opened the door for you. And when they put them cuffs on me, it gave me a little chill having them cuffs on me. And
I can understand that. I mean,
I went to the precinct and everything changed in the precinct. Detective Whitaker was very amicable. He tried to persuade me, telling them the truth, which I was, that I was in Florida would be the best thing. And then Martinez would come in after Whitaker would finish. This interrogation lasted 5 hours, and he'll tell me, we know you did it. You're a murderer, and you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. And if you don't tell me about it, you will never see your daughter. And he's giving me this. So after 5 hours, I said, all right, you want me to write a statement? And he passes me a piece of paper and a pen. And I wrote on it, and then I passed it back, and they were really pissed off of what I wrote. I said, I've never committed a crime. I've never taken someone's life, and God knows this, and it is God's will. And that was my exact statement, and that was it. From that moment on, they just processed me through the system. I spoke to Detective Silverman, who was in part of the case, which is still a mystery. He was the one showing the witnesses pictures. But he was in the homicide detectives. He was not part of the case at all. And he took the statement from me where I gave 13 alibi witnesses. In addition to that, I described where I was, the homes. I mean, detail from the staircase, the house is to the right, the bedroom is here. I gave a detailed description of where I was, the people I was with, the phone numbers, phone records, job applications, everything. And they never, not once, they didn't pick up the phone to find out if I was saying the truth.
So you're presenting them with basically ironclad evidence, right?
Absolutely.
There's really no other way to describe it. I mean, you can't have a better alibi than you were 1,000 miles away. Right? It's not like I was at the movies and my sister said she saw me and whatever. And then, you know, I mean, which is still an alibi.
Yeah.
Right?
It was impossible.
It's impossible. Here you are. Now you're in the system. Now you're in lockup. Right? Yes. You're waiting for your trial. You got a lawyer.
Yes. I'm thinking this will be over in a day. You know, they're going to find out I was in Florida. It's done. So first, I talked to the detectives, went through that. Talked to the DA, went through that. Went through the lineup with a lawyer named Rudy Velez. I was picked out of the lineup. They finally assigned me a lawyer named Joyce Hartsfield, and I poured out my heart to her because it's been more than a week now, and I'm saying, hey, I don't belong here. You know, my witnesses are in Florida. The evidence is there. Everything is there for you, and I reiterated most of the things I did to the detectives, and Joyce Hartsfield asked the judge for funds to send an investigator. I'm indigent. I don't have no money for investigators, and so the judge granted the motion.
Okay, so now you're good.
I'm supposed to be good. It's supposed to work great, right? You get the evidence. You have the investigators go. And what happened was that Joyce Hartsfield, after a year, I'm telling her, please, you know, find these people. She would not answer my letters. She would not answer my pleas, and I'm desperate.
You're calling her to collect from?
It's been, I wrote her letters. We have records of
that. She wasn't answering the calls either?
No, she was not being, she wasn't in contact with me at all, and I'm desperate. I'm in prison. I'm not seeing my children as much as I would like to. I don't belong here.
And you're in Rikers Island?
Yes, I know it's a mistake. I'm dealing with these gang members and police officers, and I'm really having a lot of trouble because, you know, I'm 20 years old and I don't belong here. And you know, you have to deal with this volatile environment that you don't belong in, and she would not answer me.
In Rikers, it's chaos.
It's chaos. It's completely chaos. I mean, from the correctional officers to the inmates, the corruption is just so, you know, abhorrent that you know, I can't even put into the words what I was experiencing. Now, all I knew is that if I had to talk to my lawyer or my wife, I had to be at the mercy of gangbangers and, you know, malicious people that are actually in there for crimes they committed. And I'm nothing like these
people. Right, just to
so
get to the phone.
What do I do to talk to my family? And, you know, unfortunately, it led to a lot of fights and tribulations and a lot of victimization, because I don't want people to think that I glamorize that. But I've been slashed. I've been stabbed. I've been jumped by inmates. And I've had to struggle and fight and claw my way out that type of environment. Even correctional officers, I've been brutalized by them. And, you know, I've stood up because I was in the right. I didn't belong there. And I had to suffer that, and, you know, my family had to suffer it. But it's chaos. It's completely chaos.
So your lawyer's not only doing nothing, but also not even returning your calls.
Yes.
So now what happens? Does she eventually come through, investigate, do something? What happens next? What leads? Let's get up to the trial. What
all
happens
right.
leading
this,
up
this
to the trial?
This is the amazing part, that I started learning law, and I had to. This lady's not defending me, so I put in a motion to have her taken off my case and giving me another lawyer. The judge does this. He gives me Stephen Kaiser. And so Stephen Kaiser comes in. He has no clue of what motion has been approved and denied. He comes in under the belief that the investigative funds were denied. No investigation.
And he never asked you.
I told him. I mean, my witnesses. I mean, here's a year later, and I'm livid. I'm talking the same thing for years. I'm innocent. This is where the evidence is at. These are the people. And he says, well, the judge denied the funds for investigators. So I don't know nothing.
Oh, so you think now that maybe the first one had it wrong.
Yeah.
Or maybe the judge changed their
yes.
mind. Or whatever it is. And now you're dealing with a lawyer who you're dealing with two lawyers, both of whom are incompetent.
Yes.
And so now, so somehow, amazingly, in between the transition from the first lawyer to the second lawyer, the information, the one thing that could have helped you, gets lost and gets screwed up,
yes.
which is the idea that there was money for someone to go to Florida,
yes.
confirm the alibis, and come back on a white horse and go,
this
very sorry,
innocent.
It's all a big mistake. Go home, let's go find the real killer. That's what's supposed to happen.
That's what's supposed to happen.
That's not what happened.
That's not what happened.
Right. So what happened now? So now you got to go to trial.
Now I got to go to trial with a lawyer that's ill-prepared to defend me.
And they're balancing all these other things. They're going to court. They're juggling all these cases.
Hundreds of cases. And,
so,
and one thing that I want to add to that, which is important, you know, I don't want to make excuses for these lawyers that misrepresented me. And, you know, it's completely appropriate to say that they dropped the ball. But before that, the DA gets the case. The police get the case. So before a lawyer touches your case, if anybody's going to know whether you're innocent or not, it's going to be the district attorney and the police. If they do the investigative work and the work that they're supposed to be doing to protect the citizens that they've been sworn to protect and serve. So the DA drops the ball. Now they give it to these overworked, overstressed lawyers. What do you think is going to happen?
Now you're back to,
mm-hmm.
you're in trial,
mm-hmm.
and the pressure's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
Now your lawyer gets up. Are there any of the witnesses from Florida that came up to testify on your behalf?
Yeah, Janine Seda and John Torres came, and the DA said, well, they're his friends. They would lie for him. But what we know now is that the DA was telling the jury a lie, that this crime that occurred was not premeditated, that it was coincidental.
So they testified on your behalf, and
yeah.
they're saying, oh, these are your friends, they'll say whatever you want. In the meantime, they came all the way up from Florida just to lie for you.
Yeah.
Okay,
that,
all right, well,
this
whatever.
And
there were some eyewitnesses for the prosecution,
yes,
is that right?
Yes, it was George Collazo's best friend, and I want to get into this because this is very telling and important for the narrative. Michael Sanchez testified, guy I never met in his life. Don't know him, never met him, don't know his history, his background. We have no connection. Robert Davis was the second witness. Don't know him, never seen him in my life. Another independent witness picked my picture out, picked me out of the lineup. And Jose Diaz, another old man, had the food truck at the time, said that he witnessed the shooting. What's amazing about all these three witnesses is that they have all said the same thing. at the time, Jose Diaz was deemed incredible because when he was asked, did you see the shooter? They said, he said, yeah, I seen the shooter. They said, do you see him in the courtroom? He says, no, I don't see him in the courtroom. And he says, but I remember a picture that I was shown. And he said that two times. And that testimony was made obsolete because now the DA has to shift and say, well, you know, he initially said it was Richard or picked out his picture. Now he's not saying that. And so these other two witnesses were allowed to testify and perjure themselves because now we know both of the witnesses are saying that what? The police told them that they had the right guy. That is how I went to trial, based on police telling these people, you know, they write these reports and said they looked at 200 pictures. We come to find out now that not only these three witnesses are saying the police showed them the pictures, but there were several witnesses in my case that they did not allow us to see, to interview, or to testify in my trial. And these witnesses said the same thing. The police came to them with a picture of one man, and they mentioned that he was somehow connected to Florida. None of these witnesses ever testified.
Right, and we don't know. I mean, they may have made some sort of a deal with them.
You know, yeah, we don't know that, but we know for a fact, at least this is what we know now. According to the witnesses, the police told them that's the right guy.
So I want to talk about this for a second. This is very interesting to me. While experts agree that eyewitness testimony is inherently flawed, Americans and potential jurors continue to place a great deal of weight in eyewitness testimony. In a 2001 survey of adults in the United States funded by the National Institute of Health, they found that 63% of Americans believe that memory works like a video camera. 48% believe memory is permanent, and 37% believe the testimony of a single confident eyewitness should be enough to convict a criminal defendant. And it should be noted that mistaken eyewitness identification was a factor in over 75% of the nation's DNA exonerations.
That's amazing.
I hope that people will remember when they take away, they'll take away from this podcast that the eyewitness identification is something that is very,
very
imperfect.
Flawed.
And it's something that you have to analyze. Was this person in a panic mode? Was it dark? Were they across the street? Do they have a motive
this
person?
Was there an ulterior motive? Because now we're finding out that the main witness, Michael Sanchez, was sleeping with the young lady that was slapped by his best friend, George Collazo, 2 weeks before the murder happened. Now, this is all speculation, but now we know that someone came up to Michael Sanchez a week before the murder and told him, we're coming after your friend. Now we know that the food truck guy saw the shooter for more than several hours. Now we know that another witness is coming and saying, well, this wasn't a coincidental shooting. This wasn't a shooting of two people that didn't know each other because the shooter called the victim by name. We know this now.
And
the DA knew this back then. So they presented to a jury fraud and misrepresentation by telling them, oh, they don't know each other. This was a mistake. Now we know there was a getaway car. But what they knew back then is that they could not prove that all those facts fit me. There was no connection with me.
Well,
so they had to lie to the jury. They had to concoct this story to get a conviction.
And what we also know that the victim was carrying a gun.
Yes.
And that his sister has testified or said on camera that he began carrying a gun because he had been threatened.
Yes.
And because he had slapped the girl that you were talking about.
Yes.
And that her friends or her family had threatened to get him. Right?
Yes.
So, again, if you would follow that trail, you would say, well, maybe, I mean, if it would seem to me, if I was a
rational
an officer
person.
Or
yeah,
detective,
a rational
I would say,
officer.
let me go check that out. That sounds a little dicey to me. You know, like, let's go see. But none of that happened.
The case ended with my picture getting picked out.
That's it. They got
and
you.
They changed the whole narrative.
And that's the criminal justice system.
We got
they
the
get
guy.
Somebody, they're poor, particularly a person of color, and you are basically about to get ground up by the gears, and that's what happened to you.
Yeah.
So you get convicted, right?
Yes.
Sort of 20 years of a 25-year-to-life sentence?
Yes.
Let's talk about the prison experience.
It's a psychological and physical torture. You know, you don't belong in this place. But now you have to face the indignations of what being a prisoner is. And with respect to the system, you know, if you committed a crime, you have to deal with these security measures. You have to get naked. You have to show cavity, your butt. You have to go through cavity searches. You have to have your family go through searches. And, you know, a lot of indignations. But if you committed a crime and this is what the system is built for, then, all right, fine. You know, they have to keep the security of the prison and safe, right? But here is a man that didn't commit a crime, and now I have to go through the same indignities. I have to deal with officers that look at me like a no good citizen, because most prisoners are considered, you know, people that are not wanted in society, people that have committed acts against society. So here I am amongst these people, I'm nothing like them, and I'm being treated as such, being pushed as such, being put in positions where it's either I have to fight to be able to talk to my family, to keep the little things that my family get me, provide me, whether it's some money for commissary. And here you have a real hardened murderer and a criminal trying to take what's yours, or a correctional officer coming in his cell because he feels that you're subhuman, you're worthless. They destroy your property, and now I'm going through these conflicts. I don't belong in here, and now I'm lashing out. I'm standing up. It's not even lashing out, saying you don't have a right to do this. You don't have a right to abuse of me. Inmates or correctional officers, I stood up, and you know, I bear the scars of it. You know, physically and internally, I bear the scars.
Every little one of those things would seem on the outside like a big problem. And there it's just one of 100 problems.
One of 100, because...
With your personal safety.
Yeah, your personal safety. And you think a correctional officer is going to protect you. And a lot of times the correctional officer is the one that opens your cell so that inmate could get in there and rob your property. Or you have, and I want to be upfront with this, not all correctional officers, for the majority, most of these people are just wanting to come in, do their job, and provide for their families. So I don't want to seem like I'm anti-corrections, because I met some great correctional officers, some great men in there that live every day to just do the best to provide for their family and do their job with some type of integrity. But then you have those small numbers of officers that, you know, and same thing with police officers, the same thing I could be said about them. For the most part, great individuals, they're here to protect our people and our communities. But you have that small percentage that just, you know, causes a adverse effect that everybody believes that all correctional officers are like this.
And I'm with you. I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm against the entire criminal justice system. I'm in favor of fixing the problems so we don't have to have more stories like yours. So let's get to the part of the exoneration and to the and to what life has been like for the last 4 months on the outside. So the day, what happened is that the new DA came into the Bronx recently, right?
Darcelle Clark, yes.
And so she came in, and all of a sudden your fate turned, your luck turned around.
Everything changed, because I want to make sure that people know these stats first. Robert Johnson, who was the DA in the Bronx for 27 years and who is now amazingly a judge, under his tenure in office, he had the lowest conviction rate in the Bronx, meaning that murderers were then being allowed to run the streets, thieves, murderers, whatever you want to call criminals, were allowed to run the streets. The conviction rate in the Bronx was the lowest in the city, but what's telling is the highest rate of wrongful convictions were in the Bronx, and they didn't have a committee. So, you know, in essence, what this is telling you is that he wasn't convicting criminals, he was convicting innocent people. And that's just a horrible statistic. And now this man is a judge.
Right.
That's like
saying the food's bad and the portions are too small, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you can't. You're striking out on both sides.
Absolutely,
that's terrible.
So that's what's happened with that, and those facts speak for themselves. But here we are, 20 years later. No one has ever done the investigation, and this new DA says, "Well, you know what? I want to start something new. She came into office under a cloud of suspicion. She wasn't voted in. They pulled the political maneuver, the Democratic Party. Robert Johnson exited through retirement, and they left the voters out and put Darcelle Clark in through the Democratic Party of voting and vetting a person. So now here she is. She has an opportunity to change these policies, and she took a bold step. And after investigating my case for the first time in 20 years, she sent investigators to Florida on a Friday. I was released on a Wednesday. This is amazing. This woman investigated my case 20 years later and deemed that there was enough evidence there of innocence to release me.
So now you're walking out into the fresh air, into the sunlight. What happened? And then what?
I felt, one way I felt relief, be with my family finally in the setting that I deserved, And I'm happy. I'm with my wife and my children. I'm with my
lawyers. They were there to greet you coming out?
Yes, they were all there. But my thing, when I came out, I felt a sense of anger because I was happy to be with my family, but it was like I was like just thrown out into society and, in a fashion where there was no empathy towards what I went through other than people wanting to know what I felt like. But DA's office, no one other than my family and, individuals like yourself, I don't have a job. I don't, have any means of providing for my wife and my children 20 years later. So I'm having a hard time reintegrating into a life of having to work, getting back into the workforce, but it's difficult for me. The transition it still is, but I'm making the best out of it.
What happened to Richard Rosario was horrible. He spent 20 years, the best years of his life, behind bars. When the criminal justice system makes a mistake, it's not just the individual that gets hurt. It's families, friends, partners, and children. Richard's children, Amanda and Richard Jr., turned their stress and grief into music, and I wanted to share this audio note and song they made for their dad.
Third one today. Never finish what we have to say.
All of my life I've been hearing, he's coming home, and I've had so much hope. One day, it really had gotten to me. I was really, really, really down, and I was sitting in our living room, and I heard my brother in his closet playing the piano riff.
It was like a sad time in the house, so I was just playing around with keys, and I just ended up coming up with this riff.
The song is about, I wish he was here for my dance recitals. I wish he was here for this and for my brother's baseball games to cheer us on, We have collect calls and we have letters and all those things, but I want to experience this world and everything that I'm doing with you. I want you to be able to enjoy it, not through pictures, but right here physically with me.
Collect calls and letters, short visits together. I wish this would end every night. I wanted to experience this world with you by my side. Hear you cheering for me from the sidelines. Hold me and tell me it's gonna be all right.
There's no words I can explain that feeling of just hearing those words that he's coming home.
I was like, don't get your hopes up. This happens all the time. We think he's coming home. And that was the craziest moment of my life.
And he's always showed love. And now that he's out, he's done it to the highest extent. Not every day I want to wake up and see his face. Every day.
And I think this is just too much for me. Oh, oh, oh. Collect calls and together, I wish this would end every night. Collect calls and letters. by my side, hear you cheer for me from the sidelines. Hold me and tell me it's gonna be alright, alright. Won't you please come home tonight? Wrap me in your arms, hold me tight. Through the darkness, see the light. Won't you please come home tonight? Won't you please come home tonight? Wrap me in your arms, hold me tight. Through the darkness, see the light. Won't you please come home tonight? I wanted to experience this world with you by my side. Hear you cheering for me from the sidelines. Hold me and tell me it's gonna be alright, alright. I wanted to experience this world.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcast. It really helps. And you know, I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause, and in so doing, helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. It's easy. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I want to thank our amazing producers, engineers, and editors, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by three-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1 and PRX.